Good morning. A European leader says allies must act as allies after President Trump called Europe weak and decaying. Have European strategies to keep Trump on their side failed? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Federal Reserve is expected to lower interest rates today, but there are divisions at the central bank. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Making it easier to borrow money would help the job market. It could also make inflation worse. Senator Ted Cruz called a far-right influencer a Nazi. Why does conservative social media host Brett Cooper say that's a mistake? It is Wednesday, December 10th. On this day in 1906, Theodore Roosevelt became the first American to win a Nobel Prize for negotiating an end to a war between Russia and Japan. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump visited a Pennsylvania resort and casino last night to tout what he's doing to make the cost of living more affordable for Americans. Speaking to a crowd, Trump insisted his administration has lowered prices compared to the Biden administration.
They gave you high prices. They gave you the highest inflation in history. And we're bringing those prices down rapidly. Lower prices, bigger paychecks.
But inflation this past September, the most recent month that was measured, was at the same point as it was during former President Biden's last month in office. During his talk last night, Trump wandered off the affordability topic and turned to bashing his opponents. He used epithets to describe countries in Africa and immigrants from Somalia.
If you don't share our values, contribute to our economy, and assimilate into our society, then we don't want you in our country. We don't want you.
Trump also insulted Minnesota Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, an American born in Somalia. She wrote online that President Trump is a national embarrassment. The Federal Reserve is expected to lower its benchmark interest rate this afternoon. NPR's Scott Horsley reports it could soon get a little bit cheaper to borrow money.
The Fed has cut interest rates by a quarter percentage point at each of its last two meetings, and investors expect another quarter point cut today as the central bank tries to prop up a sagging job market. Not everyone on the rate-setting committee agrees, however, that another reduction is warranted. Hawkish committee members are more concerned about stubbornly high inflation and may vote to hold interest rates steady. The Fed is working with less information than usual since the six-week government shutdown prevented federal workers from collecting data on inflation and unemployment in October. November's numbers have also been delayed until next week, too late to guide Fed policymakers in their decision today. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
More than a million high school students have filled out this year's federal financial aid form known as FAFSA. More seniors completed the form this fall than in recent years. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports that's despite polling that suggests many Americans are beginning to sour on higher education.
Seeing so many students fill out the financial aid form matters because it's often a critical step in the college process, and it's correlated with more students enrolling in college next year.
It's good to have good news about the FAFSA.
Bill DeBlon is with the National College Attainment Network. He says there's two main reasons the numbers are so high this year. First, the form is much simpler thanks to recent legislation by Congress. Second, it was made available way earlier, on September 24th. In the 2 years prior, the form didn't open until sometime in December. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. Voters in Miami have chosen Democrat Eileen Higgins to be their next mayor. She's the first Democrat to hold the job in about 30 years and the first woman ever to hold the job. Higgins is a former Miami-Dade County Commissioner. She defeated Republican candidate Emilio Gonzalez, who had been endorsed by President Trump. The conflict between Cambodia and Thailand continues to spiral at the border between the two countries. Hundreds of thousands of civilians in both countries have been evacuated away from the fighting. The renewed warfare comes after Cambodia and Thailand signed a peace agreement several weeks ago. The truce had been negotiated by President Trump and leaders in Malaysia. Australia has started enforcing its social media ban for children. Kids 16 and younger in Australia cannot access some of the world's biggest platforms. From Melbourne, Christina Cuclia reports.
All 10 listed platforms, including YouTube, Facebook, TikTok and X, say they will comply with the ban, which requires them to remove accounts held by underage users and prevent new ones from being created. Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says the new law will change lives.
It is one of the biggest social and cultural changes that our nation has faced. It's a profound reform.
The Australian government says more sites could still be added. That's as some of the major technology companies warn the restrictions are rushed and arbitrary and will be difficult to enforce. Australia's highest court has agreed to hear a legal challenge against the ban next year.
Christina Cuclia reporting. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
February 15th, 1898. The sinking of the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor led to the outbreak of the Spanish-American War. Minnesota troops responded by signing up to battle the Spanish in the Philippines. As they prepared to board their ship, a 17-year-old from Colorado, desperate for action, asked if he could join them. His name was Damon Runyon, and he was signed on as a bugler for the Minnesota unit. But once encamped near Manila in the Philippines, Runyon filled his hours not with music-making, but with booze and prostitutes, and also a steady stream of articles about life in the army camp. Those articles, when published in stateside papers, attracted readers who marveled at the young man's colorful prose, ear for dialogue, and amusing caricatures. A year and a half later, Runyon was discharged from the military and ultimately made his way to New York to become a journalist. And to the end of his days, Damon Runyon, whose New York stories would inspire the Broadway hit Guys and Dolls, proudly declared himself a veteran of the Spanish-American War, trotting out his Minnesota uniform, a machete for curious visitors.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadil. Good morning. European officials are saying it is time for President Trump to show them some respect. Their comments are in response to an interview Trump gave to Politico this week, where he called European leaders weak and said their countries are decaying because of immigration. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London.
Politico began its interview by naming Trump the most influential person shaping Europe.
This year, Politico broke precedent to recognize an American for the first time in history.
And the flattery,
and sir, there is no question that you are having a seismic impact,
yielded a wide-ranging interview in which Trump insulted U.S. allies. He called London Mayor Sadiq Khan, who is of Pakistani descent,
a horrible, vicious, disgusting mayor,
saying Khan owes his election victories to immigrants. European leaders want to be so politically correct, Trump said, drawing this rebuke.
Allies must act as allies.
That's European Council President Antonio Costa. He told reporters in Ireland that Europeans respect how Americans elected Trump and that Trump needs to do the same.
It's like this, that allies behave between each other.
Trump called Russia strong because of its size, Biden-era aid to Ukraine stupid, and European leaders weak. In a speech, British Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper said it's the opposite.
I see in Europe is strength, and the strength and commitment to support Ukraine.
Europe is contributing more to Ukraine's defense as Trump withdraws European security guarantees that have been here since World War II. The White House recently published a document predicting civilizational erasure in Europe, which was praised by the Kremlin. Here in London, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has generally avoided criticizing Trump. They signed an early trade deal exempting Britain from some U.S. tariffs. The strategy here has been to keep Trump close.
I think, to be honest, the time has come to realize that that strategy has failed.
Natalie Tocci, a former European Union advisor, spoke to the BBC.
Europe is alone. And the sooner we come to terms with this reality, the less the damage will be.
For Europe, she says it's now about mitigating damage from the US once its closest ally. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
For more on President Trump's relationship with Europe, we're joined by Anne Applebaum. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and historian, a staff writer for The Atlantic, who's reported from all over the world, and she's with us now. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning.
So what stood out to you in the president's remarks about Europe?
I think what stands out about the national security strategy is that Trump has given up on identifying America's rivals as Russia and China. He's given up on the idea that we play a role in the world to protect democracy, to spread freedom, even to increase prosperity of Americans by arguing for open trade. And instead, he has decided on a policy of undermining and disparaging allies. And I think that's going to prove very dangerous in the long term.
So Trump has criticized Europe before, I mean, in both of his administrations, mainly about what he said was inadequate military spending. How is this different?
Well, first of all, it's different because Europe is spending on the military. And not only that, Europe is now the main supporter, almost sole supporter of the Ukrainians. I mean, all the weapons and money going into Ukraine this year have come from Europe. So that it's not a criticism you can make anymore. Civilizational erasure is more of a far right idea. I mean, it's actually way to the right of most European far right parties. It's an idea that Europe is somehow fundamentally, you know, intellectually and emotionally and physically flawed and won't survive. And that's an existential attack that you can't fix by, you know, spending more on weapons or by having a better diplomatic relationship or by flattering the president. Trump has clearly got this impression from some of the people around him, some of whom believe this or have been promoting these ideas for domestic reasons as part of a domestic debate in the United States for a long time. And of course, it grotesquely misreads what Europe is. It misunderstands even immigration. It misunderstands that European countries are on any list you look at have the highest living standards, are the safest places to live, have the highest education, have the best environmental policies. I mean, this is a very attractive and powerful part of the world. And if the United States is now going to set itself against it and try to tear it apart, as I said, that will eventually have terrible results for the United States.
So on Monday, my colleague Layla spoke with Alexandra de Hoop-Scheffer, the president of the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Let's listen to what she had to say.
What you are seeing live today is a new transatlantic bargain where Europeans are accepting and integrating the idea that the transatlantic relationship is going to be more transactional, more conditional.
It sounds to me like she's saying that the president just finally said the quiet part out loud and that Europe has seen this coming and is already kind of adapting to this idea. Do you think that that's accurate?
If the relationship is going to be more transactional, that's a neutral, that's maybe the best possible outcome. But the NSS that was written implies that the U.S. will be actively seeking to dismantle European institutions and will be playing a role inside European politics, inside the domestic politics of European countries, which is in a contradictory way is exactly the opposite of what it said it would be doing in the autocratic world, especially in the Middle East.
And interesting.
And that will backfire.
And how do you, yes, exactly. That's what I also want to ask you. How do you think Europe's going to respond to this if that is in fact the case?
It will be a very negative response. And of course, that response is happening now. I mean, I don't know that people are going to say it in public, but yes, a very wide range of European leaders, including many on the right, will be distressed by this. European Union means a lot to the economies of Europe. The idea that the U.S. would play a role in breaking it up will be perceived very negatively. And of course, that will have consequences for Europe's willingness to help the U.S. in other situations and in other spheres.
And before we let you go, what do you think this perspective that's outlined in this national security strategy and in the president's remarks, what does this mean for Ukraine?
I mean, it's not good for Ukraine because it seems to favor Russia. So almost everything in the document reflects Russian strategy. The Russians also talk about a decline in Europe. They also want to break up the EU. They also seek to downplay the role of the U.S. in Europe. They also want to break up America and Europe. And so, unfortunately, this document is very good for Russia.
Before we let you go, we only have 20 seconds here. Are you surprised by any of this?
No, I'm not entirely surprised. I mean, this is language that's been kicking around in the American far right for many years. And I heard it before the election, and I'm not surprised to hear it now.
That's Anne Applebaum. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic and a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. Anne Applebaum, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Nobel Peace Prize will be presented later this morning in Oslo, Norway, to Venezuelan opposition leader Marina Corina Machado. The Nobel Committee says she made a journey in a situation of extreme danger and will be with them in Oslo, but won't be there for the ceremony. The award was given for Machado's, quote, longstanding struggle to achieve a just and peaceful transition from dictatorship to democracy in Venezuela. For more, we go to reporter John Otis, who has been covering Venezuela from neighboring Colombia. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
So Machado had vowed to attend today's ceremony. What happened?
Yeah, it's really been a roller coaster this morning with conflicting messages about Machado's whereabouts. The city's packed with journalists. Much of her family, including her 90-year-old mother, made the trip to Norway. Several Latin American presidents are there, and even her dress for the ceremony is apparently in place and waiting for her. Mm. The first sign of trouble came Tuesday when Machado failed to show up for a news conference, and even her press aides didn't seem to know what was going on. But remember, Machado faces a travel ban in Venezuela, and getting out of the country without getting arrested is tricky.
Right.
Other dissidents have managed to do so, but it involved sneaking across the border into Colombia or escaping by speedboat to the Caribbean island of Aruba. In Machado's case, we don't know exactly what happened, but it appears she will make it to Oslo, just not in time for the scheduled ceremony, according to the Nobel Institute.
Okay, so if she doesn't make it, will someone be accepting the prize in her place?
Well, if her mother can't make it on time, Machado's daughter, Ana Corina Sosa Machado, will be accepting the Nobel Peace Prize on her behalf. But, you know, the fact that there was so much drama surrounding Machado's arrival in Oslo could actually add more urgency to her message that Venezuela needs regime change. Mm. Whether it's her daughter or Machado at the podium, they will likely remind the audience of Machado's key role in last year's presidential election. Machado was banned from running in that race, but she helped convince millions of Venezuelans to vote for her stand-in candidate, Edmundo González. And according to voter tally sheets, González trounced President Nicolás Maduro. But Maduro's refused to give up power. González was forced into exile. Machado went into hiding, and Venezuela sort of faded from the headlines. But now her winning the Nobel plus President Trump's military buildup in the Caribbean Sea and his vows that Maduro's days are numbered have suddenly thrust Venezuela back into the news.
I mean, I want to ask you also about the criticism around Machado getting the Nobel Peace Prize when she's openly lobbying for the U.S. military to depose Maduro. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. In fact, there were some protests in Oslo from activists who view Machado as too bellicose to receive the Nobel. But Machado argues that she did push for a democratic and peaceful transition in her country in last year's election, that she played by the rules, but Maduro refused to give up power and used his armed forces to crush protests. So from Machado's point of view, military action to oust Maduro may be the only option that's left to create a more democratic and peaceful Venezuela.
That's John Otis reporting from Bogota, Colombia. Thank you, John.
Thanks.
This is NPR News.
Nation's listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, we listen to this green cheese and all the other programming on the stations. We really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local. And given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
The station. And from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay, in theaters this Friday. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits, at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The social media host Brett Cooper has drawn a following at the age of 24. What is your job, your business? How do you define it?
Oh, gosh. My job is just to talk to people.
She's one of a constellation of conservative voices who help people process the news.
I don't really consider myself a newscaster. I'm a young person who is engaged in culture and politics and is active on social media and then goes online. I literally film from my phone most of the time.
That's made Brett Cooper one of many voices debating the state of the Republican Party and President Trump. She has a popular YouTube channel, which is mostly Brett Cooper looking straight at you. Sometimes she talks pop culture.
You all probably think that you know the story of Justin Bieber, but beneath that story is another story. And another story, and
often she talks politics. In the episode that dropped just before we talked, she was praising President Trump's bid to deport people.
So I think it is safe to say that both illegal and legal immigration are absolutely, in fact, overrunning our country. And I am completely in support of this reverse migration that Trump is talking about. And you know what? These people can make their travels home just that much easier with a Noble all-in-one carry-on.
She transitioned there to an ad for luggage. Brett Cooper also criticized the president when he said America needs high-skilled immigrants. What moved you to feel you needed to speak up?
Because I think my disappointment and concern was shared by my audience and people who are like me. The thing that really spurred me into action was seeing Trump doing his Laura Ingraham interview, and I know Laura and love her. I think it was a great interview.
Because if you want to raise wages for American workers, you can't flood the country with tens of thousands or hundreds
of
thousands
agree,
of foreign workers.
I agree, but you also do have to bring in talent.
We don't have talented people here.
And everybody was talking about it, and I obviously felt like I had an obligation to speak on it because I, as a consumer, had watched that clip and went, okay, what the heck are we doing? Like, this is like the worst thing for a president to say. We don't have American talent. And he said that right after he said that the affordability crisis was just a figment of our imagination. It is a con. We have just made it up in our minds. He has no idea what we're talking about.
The opinions of people like Cooper matter when one third of Americans get their news from YouTube. Some are watching NPR videos. Our talk with Brett Cooper is on video, for example. Others are watching personalities. Cooper has drawn an audience that she says comes less for ideology than for her. Who are you talking to? Who are you hoping to talk to? And who do you know is there?
My biggest age group is the 18 to 35s, and it is a very, very even 50-50 split of men and women. And it used to not be that way. When I first started on YouTube, I think I had like a 90% male audience and 10% female, like 3.5 years ago.
What did you do you think, to attract more of that female audience?
You know, when I started, I definitely talked more about hard politics. I was working at the Daily Wire.
Yeah.
And obviously I'm interested in that kind of stuff, but at the end of the day, I love pop culture. I love trends on social media and how those are indicative of broader issues. And so I kind of looked around at my content and I was like, I'm consuming all of this. Why am I not talking about all this? Because this matters to people who are like me. And then I saw a big jump actually after I got engaged and then got married. And I think a lot of women were interested in that and wanted to hear about my experience getting married and now having a baby. And it became not just about the content and the stories that I was talking about, but me as a communicator.
Do politicians reach out to you?
Sometimes. In what way?
Congressmen, senators, like just to talk, to get their views across, to find out what you're thinking?
I think it's more about trying to figure out what I'm thinking and what my generation is thinking about. But I'm very careful about the fact that my audience shows up for me and my opinions, whether they like them or not like them. I have a large portion of my audience is actually not conservative, but they enjoy me as a person and they want to hear, you know, from the other side. And I want to make sure that I am never allowing anybody else to impact that. So I want my audience to know that if you're coming to watch the Brett Cooper Show, she doesn't have a senator in her ear saying, hey, these are my opinions, could you share them? But if I see what's going on X, if I see Ted Cruz saying something, I'm going to talk about it.
She recently had a public exchange with the Texas senator. Ted Cruz called the influencer Nick Fuentes a Nazi, which Cooper called out as a mistake.
My issue is with free speech. You should be allowed to say whatever you want, and we should encourage people to share their ideas. And if you don't like them, ignore them.
She talked of the Streisand effect, the idea that criticizing people just brings them more attention.
For Gen Z, what people on both sides of the political aisle need to realize is the more that you tell my generation not to watch something, not to look into something, not to listen to something, that something is bad, or censor somebody, we're going to go look for that content because we're interested.
Well, let's take for granted as part of this conversation that people have a right to say what they want to say.
Yes.
There is then the matter of what Nick Fuentes and some other people have said. Fuentes, this is a quote from a video in an interview with Alex Jones.
Which is, what are we to do about this Jewish elite, these Jewish gangsters that run our Christian country?
And in the Tucker Carlson interview, he talks about how he feels that Jews are extremely organized across borders and more loyal to Israel than to their home countries, which is a longtime anti-Semitic idea. When we get down to the substance of what Nick Fuentes says, do you agree with it?
You know, I don't agree with Nick Fuentes on everything. I don't agree with anybody on everything. I think that what especially older generations need to learn about Nick Fuentes is that he says it himself, he's an edgelord. He says things that are intentionally inflammatory, and honestly, I don't pay much attention to it.
Do you think that Jewish gangsters are controlling the country?
No, not really. I am concerned about the impact of Israel in our country. I think that a lot of young people are.
And when Ted Cruz, this senator who had this exchange with you, says, now is a time for choosing. Either you call out this guy or you're a coward and you're complicit. Is he right at all?
I think that as Americans, you should be allowed to listen to whoever you want to listen to. I don't think that I need to sit here and condemn anyone either way.
In his exchange with Cooper, Senator Cruz wrote, quote, I don't know who this angry lady is. The point is, many people do know.
And to get to the point now where I could sit in interviews like this and I can defend my beliefs and my values, when I can get up online every single day and release videos muddling through complex issues, I have so much fun with it. And they've changed my life because they've made me more empowered. And I think that they've made me a better Brett.
Brett Cooper, it's a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
She's the creator of The Brett Cooper Show. Our interview with her is on YouTube and the NPR app. There's so much more. We talk about everything from trad wives to Afghan refugees. This is NPR News.
This Division is a widescreen movie format from the 1950s.
There's no grain, and the image clarity is beautiful. It showed the full view of your eye, like what your vision sees in your peripherals.
It fell out of fashion over the decades, but this year, two buzzy films were shot with restored VistaVision cameras. More on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday morning show. I'm Andrew DeZingle. And thank you to everyone who donated to KXE this year. You've made a difference with your contributions. We can't thank you enough. You can still help us finish our year strong. Give at KAXE.org. Bemidji Community Theater presents The Spirit of Christmas, a variety show featuring dramatic readings, singing, handbells, and dancing. Shows are 7 p.m. on Friday, December 12th and Saturday, December 13th. Tickets available at the door. And Misabi Symphony Orchestra's Christmas Spectacular is Friday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at Rock Ridge High School in Virginia. It's a family-friendly evening of music, decorations, treats, and a visit from Santa. You can learn the sport of curling at Itasca Curling Club in Grand Rapids Friday, December 12th or December 19th at 6 p.m. Be sure to bring in clean athletic shoes and wear comfortable clothes and a light jacket. The Clearwater County Historical Society in Shevlin hosts the Festival of Trees. Enjoy more than 30 trees and vote for your favorite. Donations of non-perishable food items are encouraged. Special events are each weekend through December 21st. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kivy, exploring the distinctly American art form. Tune in Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. Concordia Language Villages near Bemidji has their International Holiday Market, December 11th through the 14th, from 10 to 6 each day. Shop ornaments, apparel, food, and more from 14 different cultures. The Minnesota DNR invites you to an introduction to snowshoeing at the Lost 40 Scientific and Natural Area, northeast of Alvwood, Saturday, December 13th from 2 to 3 p.m. Dress for the weather and bring snowshoes if you have them. Now it's time for your Daily Dose of Phenology.
On today's date, December 10th, 2006, I spot a rusty blackbird down along the banks of a backwater of the Mississippi River. The bird is not the black of the summer, but rather a sort of a mottled brown. And at first, I'm confused over its identity, but checking the field guide, I am assured that it is a rusty blackbird. It has a pale iris. It's a slender bird, not quite as thick and bulky as the red-winged blackbird. It eats insects, and this time of year, probably getting seeds from along the edge of the backwater there. It typically is found near spruce trees and bogs, sometimes marshes. It is this time of year most likely to be found in southern Minnesota, the southeastern corners of Minnesota, or somewhere to the south of that. In the summertime, this bird is not common. It's never common across its range, but it's not common in northern Minnesota, but more likely to be found north of the border. So watch for the rusty blackbird. You may be surprised.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers unbox the unexpected over the holidays with British TV, including original series Linley and a new season of Karen Peary, streaming at BritBox.com. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Federal Reserve is expected to cut interest rates today, but the path to that decision could be bumpy.
Yeah, the central bank is trying to keep a lid on both inflation and unemployment. And members of the Fed's rate-setting committee are divided over which of those goals is more urgent.
NPR's Scott Horsley is with us now to tell us more about this. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
So why do forecasters expect a rate cut today?
We have seen a real slowdown in the job market in recent months, and a number of Fed policymakers are very concerned about that. Over the summer, we saw a net loss of jobs in both June and August. The unemployment rate has been inching up. Fed Governor Chris Waller has been saying for months now the warning signs are flashing on the job market, and the central bank should lower interest rates to prevent a further deterioration.
The labor market is still weak and near stall speed.
The Fed already cut its benchmark interest rate in September and October, and a third cut would make it a little bit cheaper to borrow money, so consumers might spend a bit more, and businesses, in turn, might need to hire more people.
So that's the argument for cutting rates, but it sounds like it's not a slam dunk.
It's not, because we've still got the specter of inflation out there. That's the other part of the Fed's job, and some policymakers think getting prices under control is a bigger concern right now than the softening job market. Prices are still climbing faster than the Fed would like. Just yesterday, we got some survey data showing that a lot of small businesses are raising prices. There's concern that the president's tariffs will continue to push prices up in the new year. Susan Collins, who heads the Boston Federal Reserve Bank, voted for rate cuts in both September and October, but she says the bar is pretty high before she would vote for a third cut this week.
Absent evidence of a notable labor market deterioration, I'd be hesitant to ease policy further, especially given the limited information on inflation due to the government shutdown.
Because of that six-week shutdown, we don't know what the unemployment rate was in October, and we don't know what the inflation rate was that month, because the federal workers who were furloughed were unable to gather that data. What's more, the numbers for November, which the Fed would ordinarily have in its hands at this meeting, won't come out until next week. So policymakers are at a bit of a handicap here as they try to steer the economy through thicker than usual fog.
How unusual is it to have this much division on the rate-setting committee?
You know, the Fed likes to operate by consensus. It's not uncommon to have some disagreement, but it is unusual to have a lot, and in particular to have disagreement in both directions. At the last Fed meeting, we had two dissents, one from a committee member who thought the Fed was cutting rates too aggressively, and another who thought the Fed wasn't moving fast enough. It's been 6 years since there were three dissents on a Fed vote, and it's been 33 years since there were four dissents. It's possible we could see that many today.
And before we let you go, should we look for more rate cuts in the future?
President Trump is certainly calling for more, but we'll see. You know, Fed officials will update their forecast today of where they think interest rates are likely to go next year. Back in September, the average Fed policymaker was projecting only one quarter-point rate cut in 2026. We'll see if that outlook has changed at all. Right now, investors think there is a better-than-even chance that we could see more rate cuts next year.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
In 3 weeks, federal subsidies that make it less expensive for people to buy health insurance through the Affordable Care Act will expire. Congress is scheduled to vote on a proposal from Democrats to extend those subsidies this week, but it's not expected to pass. While Congress debates what policy could come next, Colorado and a few other states are trying to keep health care costs in check themselves. Here's John Daly of Colorado Public Radio.
Chelsea Baker Houck has a lot on her plate.
Well, today I am hooked up to an IV all day and all day yesterday getting my immunoglobulin infusion.
She spoke to me from a medical clinic in Denver. She's been battling long COVID, a heart condition, and an autoimmune disease that requires treatment every 2 weeks.
I'm a lifer.
One stressor she didn't need is uncertainty about her health coverage. Baker Houck runs a consulting business and gets the enhanced federal tax credit to help pay for the insurance she buys through Colorado's marketplace. Last year, she paid $239 a month after getting a $313 tax credit. If Congress does not renew the subsidies, the cost of the insurance she's now shopping for is set to rise sharply.
It's a lot more. It's more than twice what I was paying last year.
In anticipation, Colorado took steps to help protect coverage for those like Baker Houck.
Today, members, we're here to proudly present House Bill 25B,
10:06.
Lawmakers met in a special session over the summer called by Governor Jared Polis. The Democratic majority introduced legislation. It aims to blunt the impact of the loss of the federal subsidies. Here's co-sponsor Lindsay Gilchrist.
This bill will provide $100 million to prevent, as best we can, the massive cost increases Coloradans will otherwise face.
It paved the way for a $100 million interest-free loan from a trust fund of unclaimed property to help reduce premium costs for consumers. Democrats passed it over the objections of Republicans, like Representative Dusty Johnson, who didn't like the way the state would pay for it.
We are passing the buck by robbing Peter or robbing the people of Colorado because this is their dollars, not government dollars. This is the people's dollars that they have the right to claim back.
But state leaders say if the enhanced tax credits aren't renewed, it'll be a disaster for the state's health system and will drive more people to become uninsured. Colorado is not the only state to take action, says Matt McGough, a policy analyst with KFF, an independent health policy group.
States are just trying to fill in where they can.
Democratic-led states, some with strong state marketplaces like California, Maryland, and Massachusetts, have also tried to help their residents. They're offering state-funded premium assistance like Colorado, or leaning on state programs that help soften the blow for insurance companies dealing with high-cost claims. Or, McGough says, they're ramping up consumer outreach.
But everything that they're doing is a drop in the bucket of what the federal government has done and is rolling back this year.
And none of these state efforts are permanent, he says.
From my understanding, a lot of these are just emergency measures, one-time fixes that provide a gentle landing.
Insurance customer Chelsea Baker Houck says she's grateful to state leaders for the help, which would save her $80 a month.
This is a step in the right direction. I mean, $80 is a lot for me right now, so that adds up.
Meanwhile, she's already cutting back on spending to cope with the much higher health insurance costs she fears.
One of the things I've been doing is stopping medications, especially the ones that I have to pay out of pocket for.
Baker Houck says it's unfortunate, but for now, she doesn't have a choice. For NPR News, I'm John Daly in Denver.
This is NPR News.
It's the people of northern Minnesota that power KAXE.
I'm a member because I feel a sense of belonging being part of KAXE, because I know that they are representing me and the communities and people in our area and the work that we're doing in such a truthful and honest way. I love being able to share it nationally and tell people I've met across the nation, like, you can understand more about what it's like to live in northern Minnesota by listening online. There's so much that is of value to people anywhere. It's just an honor to contribute and be part of it.
Help us out. Tell us why you are a member. Text us at 218-326-1234 and keep KAXE powered. We're independent, we're local, we're not run by corporations, the government, or a national network. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
You are tuned in to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has their monthly brunch buffet Sunday, December 14th from 9 to noon. There will also be a craft and goodies sale. The Buck Lake Community Center is located 12 miles north of Nashwauk on Highway 65. And find the latest Up North report at KAXE.org. News from our region. Heard on The Morning Show, World Cafe, and All Things Considered, or as a podcast. Is there news in your region we should know about? Email news at KAXE.org. Chair in Virginia has a free community meal Sunday, December 21st from noon to 4. A hot meal will be served and clothing and food items will be distributed. If you have food or clothing to donate, you may bring items to Chair at 510 Chestnut Street in downtown Virginia. Essentia Health in Brainerd invites you to the Tree of Life Memorial Service and Lighting Ceremony Tuesday, December 16th at 4 p.m. You can remember the life of a loved one through poems or scripture and hang an ornament. Proceeds from free will donations will go towards grief support services at St. Joseph's Medical Center. And share a story of your longest night at Watermark Art Center Story Slam Thursday, December 18th at Bemidji Brewing. Music begins at 6 with stories at 7. All experience levels are welcome. Contact Watermark to pre-register. Now we'll take you back to Morning Edition here on KAXE KBXE.
R comes from the station. And from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more, MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The Chinese-American dish chop suey is a holiday classic.
Chop suey, chop suey.
This Broadway show tune dates back to the 1950s when chop suey was a more common menu item. Eventually, it became a Chinese restaurant staple for Jewish people and others who don't celebrate Christmas if they dined out on Christmas Day when many other restaurants closed. NPR's Netta Ulibi has more.
What is smelling so amazing in the kitchen of Miranda Brown?
Bell peppers cooking with some garlic.
Brown is a professor of Chinese history at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. She became interested in the history of chop suey a few years ago and offered to make it.
It's a dish that is chopped offal.
Offal, the gutsy stuff, O-F-F-A-L. For many years in this country, we've thought of chop suey as a mishmash of stir-fried ingredients, Brown says. But what first made chop suey was organ meat.
Lung, liver, tripe, kidneys.
Rich in flavor and nutrients, offal was once more commonly enjoyed than it is today. As she stirs and livers into the bubbling wok on her stove, Brown says the texture of offal is at least, for some, part of its appeal.
It can be chewy, buttery, rubbery. For some people, that's really kind of exciting, bouncy.
And this dish bounces back in history much further, she says, than you might expect.
We have references to chop suey, zasui in Mandarin, in Ming Dynasty texts. So The Journey to the West, which is a famous novel, has a reference to chop suey, zasui.
That novel from 400 years ago is still adapted into TV shows and movies in China, like one from 2013, where a character enjoys a lavish banquet. In real life, Brown says, chop suey was part of ceremonial meals in Imperial China.
And so you will find it on fancy banquet menus. A version of the dish was even eaten at the Qing court.
When Chinese immigrants to the U.S. in the 1800s wanted to build relationships with local officials, Brown says, they held similar banquets. 300-course meals that would be written up in newspapers. Peking duck, bird's nest soup, chop suey.
All the bling foods that were popular when you had to make a good relationship with a person who had a lot of say about your life.
Although the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 heavily restricted immigration, Chinese restaurants spread rapidly across the United States. Chop suey became a favorite. In 1926, Louis Armstrong recorded a song called Cornet Chop Suey. The dish became a beloved ambassador to what had been to many an unfamiliar cuisine.
It was exotic, involved a little bit of adventure, and it is a name that people can pronounce.
In the movie A Christmas Story, set in the 1940s, a white working-class family celebrates Christmas at a Chinese restaurant in Indiana. Its sign says Chop Suey Palace. But within decades, Brown says,
it fell from grace, you know, in a very big way. I grew up in San Francisco and never encountered it on a menu in the 80s.
By then, chop suey was widely seen as inauthentic, no longer the tempting organ meat melange that had once impressed aristocracy. Professor Miranda Brown cooks from her own mixed heritage, half white and half Chinese. Chop suey, she says, reflects a people's resilience and adaptation.
Foods evolve. I mean, I always think, like, if I met my great-great-grandparents, would they recognize me? Would they see elements of their faces in mine? And I would guess not.
Something similar happened with Chinese food in America, she says.
When a dish leaves, 100 years later, it has evolved a lot.
Miranda Brown thinks it's time for chop suey's next evolution in the form of a comeback. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
should give as you are able, because the need is immediate.
Longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. This is the time. This is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at KAXE.org. Thank you for your support.
Free lunch warning of the week, this time about home loan refinancing.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Yubico, makers of the YubiKey. YubiKey helps protect important digital applications and services. YubiKey, still undefeated, the original passkey. More at yubico.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Good morning to you. First, Texas has launched the first state-run cryptocurrency reserve with a $5 million purchase of Bitcoin. Texas has also been very welcoming to electricity-intensive data centers that create new cryptocurrency, these Bitcoin miners. And other states are looking to add crypto to their state coffers. Marketplace's Nova Safo has more.
Texas welcomed crypto mining after China banned it in 2021. And by one count, at least 60 power-hungry crypto mines, essentially computer clusters running 24/7, are now operating in the state.
Texas has had a tremendously open grid situation with plenty of electricity.
That's Ed Herz, an energy fellow at the University of Houston's Department of Economics. And while a $5 million Bitcoin reserve is not much, Lee Bratcher of the crypto industry trade group Texas Blockchain Council says it matters for the companies that now call the state home.
It does send a powerful signal that Texas is going to be and continues to be a pro-business state that's open for innovation. Texas is making a play to be where the future of finance and capital formation happen.
But Hillary Allen of American University says the signal Texas is really sending is that there are governments willing to back cryptocurrencies, which can have wildly fluctuating prices.
I think, you know, this is something that the crypto industry wants, because they want to have this baseline demand to sort of keep the floor from falling out completely under these crypto assets.
Some Texas lawmakers say a crypto reserve can be a good investment because the state can sell assets later for a profit. And other state governments may soon follow suit. Arizona and New Hampshire have enacted laws to create similar crypto funds. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Student loan borrowers, check to see if you got cheaper terms for repaying, specifically under a plan dubbed SAVE from 2023. The Trump administration has long called SAVE illegal and has now announced plans to stop new people from enrolling and to move borrowers into other repayment plans. SAVE lets some people pay less based on income or family size, or to stop interest rate payments from ballooning.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Fidelity Investments. A dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
and by Progressive Insurance. Customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto. Learn more about bundling at progressive.com.
Just over 7 hours, we'll get confirmation from the Federal Reserve about what is very likely a small 0.25 percentage point drop in a short-term interest rate to perhaps pump some more energy into an economy with weak spots. But don't think that translates into lower home loan rates necessarily. A sense among bond market participants that we might get fewer rate cuts from central banks in 2026 is currently driving up 30-year bonds today, which could push up mortgage rates. This is just one reason. If you get a phone call offering mortgage refinancing with no cost to you, beware. Let's get more from Jacob Faber, an associate professor of sociology and public service at New York University. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
One of our reporters shared this story the other day. Her mom received a call from a lender promising her that with lower mortgage rates, she could reduce her monthly mortgage payment and it wasn't going to cost her anything. But sure enough, the mother's now on the hook for the fees associated with refinancing and new terms for the loan. Are you seeing the likes of this out there?
Absolutely. We are hearing a lot of reports of calls like this. You know, it's important to distinguish between outright scams where people are being lied to by someone claiming to be an underwriter or, mortgage rescuer, but that person doesn't actually represent your lender. And real offers from lenders that sound great, but don't end up benefiting the borrower in the end.
I mean, if it's fraud, it's fraud. But wrapping the cost into a refinancing package is legal. I mean, it's what you would expect at some level.
That's true. That doesn't mean that it's good for the borrower. So it can be difficult to understand how a homeowner can balance short-term costs of refinancing against, medium and long-term savings of a lower interest rate. And it's always important to remember that your lender's primary incentive is to make profit and not necessarily make the best decision for your specific circumstance. You know, there's never a free lunch. And, speaking as someone who has been studying the mortgage industry for well over a decade and buying a home this past summer, it still was hard for me to understand all of the things that were going on and were being offered to me in that instance.
What are some of the warning signs that you look out for when trying to negotiate a complex deal like this?
You know, anything that sounds strange or too good to be true, this is going to cost nothing, is a pretty big flag. People being asked to pay fees up front or, cancel their mortgage payments or send them to someone other than who they've been sending them to. And anyone who's being too aggressive, putting pressure on you to agree to something or asserting that something will definitely guarantee a financial return. These are all things we should be worried about.
If you're sitting there alone trying to make a huge money decision like this, it might behoove you to get some expert opinion or some other family opinion or to talk to at least one other person before agreeing to something.
I'll also say that Google search will lead you to many useful resources that are provided by, state-level governments. There's plenty of advice available for how to avoid these types of scams and how to make the calculation of whether or not refinancing at any particular time is worth it.
Jacob Faber teaches at New York University. Thank you so much for the time.
Have a good one.
Markets, S&P futures are down less than 0.1% now. NASDAQ futures are down about 0.2% as central bankers deliberate later this morning on how to handle weakness in the job market at a time prices are still going up at a time of tariffs. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Northwoods Friends of the Arts and Cook presents It Starts With an Idea, a multimedia exhibit by Mary Lou Ellison, now through December 27th. The American Red Cross is in need of blood and platelet donations to help keep supplies steady over the holiday season. Find a blood drive near you at redcrossblood.org. Apple Blossom Village Nature School in Bemidji has a winter fair fundraiser Saturday, December 13th at Rail River Folk School from 10 to 2. There's a craft and bake sale with homemade soup and bread available for lunch. Then from 3 to 5, head outside.